and welcome to the Library Cafe on WVKR, a weekly program of conversation with scholars, librarians, and others about the creation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. We've been away for the summer, but we're back with a great lineup of guests for the fall, and our first guest, whom I'm talking with by telephone today, I'm very excited about. He is David Lankus, professor and dean scholar for the new librarianship at Syracuse University School of Information Studies, and he's also the director of the Information Institute of Syracuse. We'll be talking about his two books, The Atlas of New Librarianship, which won the 2012 ABC Clio Greenwood Award for the best book in library literature, and also his Expect More, Demanding Better Libraries for Today's Complex World, which came out in paperback this year. Welcome, David.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you on the show. I should say I took your four-week MOOC, your massively online course in new librarianship over the summer, and I have to say I was really excited and energized by it. Librarians are pretty good at embracing change, I think. But even so, I can't help but sometimes wonder if the temple isn't about to fall down around our ears and I'm just not really paying attention. We hear cries of doom that libraries are antiquated institutions that can't survive the latest developments of the information revolution, sometimes from seemingly intelligent people. We hear that with digital technology, virtually all reading material will be accessed remotely, and that Google essentially has replaced library reference services, and that also you hear often that the lending model of distribution can't hold up in a digital environment where the traditional rules of copyright and first sale don't seem to apply. And of course, we hear the same kinds of things about bookstores, and then we do see bookstores closing around us, even large stalwart chains like Borders. So it's understandable, perhaps, that librarians are nervous, if not pessimistic. And then, of course, we do read every day about school and public libraries being closed or being threatened with closure and communities having to fight to keep them open. So my first question is, and of course this is a setup question, are the pessimists right and are librarians and libraries becoming obsolete?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question and it has a lot that goes behind it. And so let me dig into it for a minute. The first is the future going to be the same for libraries as it is for librarians? Mm-hmm. You know, one of the questions that I often ask my students and other people is, if we look at the future and we see a future with fewer libraries and more librarians, would that be a bad thing? You know, we have librarians that work in many different contexts. Some of them are working at large banks. Some of them are working for not-for-profit organizations. Some of them are independent consultants. Some of them don't call themselves librarians. Some of them do. You know, we have this wonderful category for special librarians where we sort of put everyone who didn't fit into academic school or public.
Yeah.
And yet, what if that pool grows? I was having an interesting conversation with some folks in the museum world, and, you know, they're having a lot of these same conversations. And what was interesting is they said, you know, we see a world where we have museum specialists, museum professionals who work in museums. And increasingly, we see people working outside of museums. And I sort of looked at that because I have a very naive view of the museum world. And I said, well, what the heck do they do? The exact same thing that people look at when you say librarians are, who aren't familiar with the area, you go, what do? And the answer was, you know, they provide provenance, they provide collection, and they provide a way of thinking about artifacts and materials and et cetera. And they said, you know, we see a world where someday we may prepare museum professionals for those who work in buildings and those who work outside of. And I said, you know, we could see a future where we prepare librarians to work in the buildings and those to work outside of.
Yeah.
And, you know, what might be really interesting is that the museum in-building people and the library in-people building might actually merge, and the museum out-of-building and the library out-of-building people might merge into a different profession.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing is, I really like to break down the difference between the future of libraries as institutions and buildings and repositories and librarians. But that's sort of sidestepping the nature of your question, which is, do we even need these skills to begin with? And in Miami, Florida, you know, they threatened to close a bunch of public libraries, a bunch of branches. And just, I think yesterday, they announced, no, good news, we can keep all the branches open. However, we're going to have them on reduced hours, and we're going to basically staff them with no one.
Yeah.
And the question is, you know, was that a success? Was that, yeah, yay, yes. Are we proud of that? And the thing is, if you understand the library to be a building with a bunch of books and materials into it, then they did a good thing. But we know within the profession that doesn't help. You just have a bunch of books piled in the middle of a big room. That doesn't really help you build knowledge. That doesn't help you develop how you understand the world. And so there's a little shame on us if people think that they can save and keep the buildings open, lose the librarians, and they've saved their library.
Yeah.
We need to do a better job of explaining that there's a lot that goes into a library aside from books. And frankly, the same can be applied to things that aren't books at all. There's a library of building materials where architects and designers can go in and see what the latest materials are and how they work and et cetera. It's not a book. There are librarians who help organize the web and organize material. They provide reference services and consulting services outside of it. They're doing librarianship, but they're not necessarily doing it in a library.
Yeah, there's seed libraries that are a very interesting concept.
Yeah, seed libraries, libraries of all sorts of things, but increasingly the people power, you talked about the knowledge side of things.
Mm-hmm.
The knowledge side of things are increasingly librarians doing stuff without a collection at all,
mm-hmm.
and which we can talk about. But,
yeah.
but you know, the part of it is also that we need to think about what that future is. And the librarians, and with their communities, need to think about what they need in the future. If they don't need the big repository of fiction, if they don't need the big repository of electronic stuff, do they still need someone to help guide them through that information, handle the licensing agreements? Do they need people that can provide the on-demand tutoring services? Do they need people who understand the idea of what first use is and defend it? Do they need people who keep us from a dark age when, you know, our discs become unreadable? And did someone care enough to worry about preservation and access over time? And I think that that's really in our hands much more than it is some sort of presumed future where, well, now that everything's digital and we have Google, we don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
The question becomes, now that everything's digital and we have Google, what can we do now?
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that's a much more interesting question.
Yeah, interesting. You make this wonderful statement along these lines that a room full of books with no librarian is a closet, while an empty room with a librarian is a library. You know, the words, I think, should be engraved over the entryways of every library and information science department. Something really all of us ought to memorize who are in the profession. And your whole approach to libraries and the profession of librarianship is focused on librarianship, isn't it? In the fact that you talk at least as much about librarians as you do about libraries. So I wonder if you could talk about your mission statement for librarians and why librarians play so central a role in your vision for the future. You know, you refer to us as radical agents of positive change, which is a very exciting and sort of ennobling way for us to look at ourselves.
So the mission of a librarian to me is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in their communities. And there's sort of two parts to that. One is the notion of improving society,
mm-hmm.
and the other is how we do it, which is means of facilitation, and we're in the knowledge business, and et cetera. And the idea is that we look at knowledge, and we can get into the philosophy of knowledge, but
mm-hmm.
let's take just a more commonly understood term of learning. We take the idea that, you know, by learning about the world, by learning about other cultures, by learning about other subjects, by learning about a subject in depth, by getting educated, whether formally or informally, we are opening up opportunities to people. We take that for granted in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we take it for granted so much that we pay a huge amount for it, particularly at the post-secondary level, to the point that we may be bankrupting people towards it. But taking this idea that, you know, by learning, by engaging with ideas of all sorts, we gain capability, we gain perspective, we gain power. Librarians are in that business, not
mm-hmm.
in documenting it, not in watching it, not in archiving it, not in providing materials to it, but actually the learning itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that anyone involved in that function, if we see the function of learning as opening up and improving power and opportunity, librarians need to model it as well as support it. And they need to be part of this process of learning. And that's a radical approach, if you will. And I love the word radical because
mm-hmm.
it has three different distinct meanings. The first is the one that I think that people will take away, which is radicals and semi-leftist, but the idea of against the norm, you know, fighting the man, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But the other radical, which is what they use in biology and medicine, means fundamental and at the root of, right? When you have a surgery for a radical gallbladder surgery, it doesn't mean they're doing something crazy. It means they take the whole gallbladder out,
mm-hmm.
not just part of it. And the third one, of course, is radical from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles as being kind of cool and hip. And what I love is the idea that librarianship really is all three of those senses. Yeah.
There's also the notion of the catalyst, the radicalist catalyst that kind of feeds
something. Yeah, from chemistry.
Yeah.
Right? And so we can talk about the idea that when we engage within our communities, we're really trying to open up lots of possibilities. And we do it by providing them with access to lots and lots of ideas with things like intellectual freedom and not censoring those ideas. And that's sort of radical in one sense. Mm-hmm. But we do it from a very valued perspective. We do it in a very conscious and principled manner, radical in another perspective. And we try to make it engaging and interesting, radical in another perspective. And we try and bring about positive change, radical in another perspective. So radical positive change agents, one of those we can deconstruct it a lot. But it comes down to that isn't keeper of the books, that isn't circulating of the materials, that isn't maintaining the building. Mm-hmm. Right? Those are all tools that we make as part of that process. And so a librarian, do they need a collection to do that? I don't think so. Will they build a collection? Maybe, probably. But the collection is only one of the tools they bring to that process.
So should librarians be political in the sense that, you know, we're talking about librarians empowering their communities or helping communities empower themselves?
You know, it's an interesting question, and it's one that actually during the MOOC came up. Actually wasn't in the MOOC, but sort of a sideline very specifically where someone was talking about somehow I'm advocating the idea of, you know, this sort of leftist agenda where we're out marching against powers that be, et cetera, and that librarians, in fact, should be neutral and unbiased. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, they can't. No one. Human beings cannot be neutral and unbiased. We grow with biases. We grow and have them, and while we can try and acknowledge them or see them, they're still there. I mean, even from the point of a librarian to answer a question goes to a physical book or goes to an electronic resource, they're showing a preference or a bias.
Sure.
Right? So the idea is that we can't be unbiased, that librarians can be intellectually honest. We can say, look, this is my view. I'm going to acknowledge it, and I'm going to try and counter it, provide multiple perspectives, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, there's a perspective here that's going on. So from that standpoint, political as in being apolitical or unbiased, I don't think librarians can. Political as in participating in the democratic system? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that librarians empower their communities to be part of a democratic society. That means more than just voting, but actually being engaged and involved, watching what their government is doing, watching policy and all that kind of thing. And so aiding a political process, yes. Taking a specific political viewpoint on welfare or the welfare state, et cetera, I don't think that that's necessarily part of being partisan. I don't think facilitating a political process does not equate to being partisan and therefore ignoring alternate points of view and only serving one ideology. I don't think that that's the case. But there is inbuilt into our values and our traditions and how we've been serving people for hundreds of years, there's a built-in political system here. When we talk about the idea of intellectual access and freedom of intellectual access and providing people with access to a wide range of ideas, that has a political overtone to it. Mm-hmm. The notion that when we talk about empowering or improving a community, that has power implications. We like the word empower. It sounds nice and sweet and idealistic. We empower people. Mm-hmm. But what that means is to give them power. I mean, that's literally what it means. And in order to give someone power, you must have power yourself to give. You know, if reading is empowering, you have to read, right? If yes. Using the internet is empowering, you have to have access to the internet. And so when we talk about, in essence, lobbying for broadband connectivity, for lobbying for literacy and reading, for lobbying for education and access to materials, that is a political participation. It may not be politically, ideologically aligned with different parties and such, but it is talking about how we govern ourselves and allocate our resources.
So are we talking here about librarians essentially imparting power to the masses?
Of course we are. I mean, once again, the reason that we have public libraries that is because as a society we have given libraries power. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what it means. When we give them a charter, when we give them tax dollars, when we give them a special place in how we govern ourselves with the idea of how we appoint staff and how we allocate tax dollars in the policies and procedures that we make available, mm-hmm. we as a society have granted public libraries and in smaller cases in academics when we give them tuition dollars and when we give them departmental standing and we give them access to tenure systems and you pick the system you want. We have given libraries power in essence to enable and empower the citizenry. mm-hmm. right? Writ large. We unchained the books writ large, so because we felt that libraries needed the power to promote literacy, and that meant lending and loaning and sending things home and et cetera. So no, I think it's very much that libraries writ large are here to empower society writ large.
Yes, but empowerment means then that communities have the opportunity and duty to create their own knowledge. I suppose what I ought to have said was it's not up to librarians to essentially distribute and disseminate knowledge as though it's a one-way thing, that we have the knowledge and we're giving it out. So.
No, what I don't think that libraries are in the business of, or should ever be in the business of, is defining what is right information and wrong information, mm-hmm. defining what is right knowledge and wrong knowledge, it's sort of writ large, and handing it in one-way direction. Absolutely not. You're correct. What I see is that libraries work within individual communities to identify what are the needs of that community and then go about filling those needs and knowledge needs, right? Because there are lots of different needs a community has, from security and enforcement of fire protection, and the idea of their knowledge needs. What do they need to develop and invent knowledge? Sometimes that's access to other members of the community. Sometimes that is access to books or written materials. Sometimes it's access to technology and tools to help mm-hmm. them craft it. And that really is defined within a community context, not generically. One thing that drives me nuts is when I look at libraries in upstate New York, and I look at a public library in Seattle, and I look at a public library in Namibia, in mm-hmm. Africa, and they look the same. And you sit there and go, why in the world do these look that they have all reference desks and they're all Dewey decimals behind it and all this other stuff? And it's nuts, because the knowledge of a community, the shape it takes, the form it takes, the communication it takes, the emphasis it takes, is really local. Mm-hmm. And that libraries need to act and think much more locally than they do with standards across the profession.
Interesting. I wonder if there's an analogy with the notion of the term church. You can think of a church as an institution, sometimes a centralized institution, mm-hmm. Or a building, and also you can include the people who operate the institution, but the bedrock definition seems to me, in the ideal at least, that a church is nothing more or less than a human community, and that the same might be said about libraries in the way you understand them in the new librarianship.
Yeah, I had a student who came to me one day, and you know, she was actually an alumni. She's been out for a year, and we were sort of talking about how it was going, and she goes, she sort of whispered and said, you know, I don't say this too loud, but I really feel like I'm the parish priest or missionary sitting among my community. And I said, absolutely, be loud about that, because I don't disagree with the analogy. I mean, the idea of, once again, what is that dedication to some sort of global understanding or standard, we can debate, but the notion that it is of building a community and supporting the community and reifying the community is what it's all about. The one caveat there is that the librarian is part of that community and therefore has a voice.
Yeah.
You know, one of this notions that you can walk into a community, say, I'm a librarian, and people assume that, back to that idea of being neutral, which comes from the root word neutered, that somehow you don't have a point of view is wrong.
Yeah.
You know, if the community comes in and says, you know what, we all decided that the following 12 books are to be banned, the librarian better well stand up and say, why, how, what's the process, and frankly say, is this going to get in the way of the idea of intellectual access and freedom?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a voice.
Yeah.
And so compromise and working within the community is important, but this idea that the community gets to say everything, there's still the notion that the librarian, back to that first part of the mission, is about improving society, and that means they have to have a vision of what improving means.
So what about books? Haven't libraries always been about books, and the culture of libraries about what might be called the romance of reading? Another setup question, but
libraries have been around for 3,000 years, so they've been around before books existed. Mm-hmm. And you can say, oh, all right, fine, scrolls are just books, but they're laid out linearly, and that's not quite true, right? Gutenberg, when he developed the printing press, it took them 100 years to invent things like title pages and footnotes and page numbers, because they were all based on single production illuminated manuscripts. Life evolves as the technology evolves. So from that standpoint alone, libraries have not always been about books. But the idea that they're about these containers, these artifacts, that's, I think, a really debatable question. I personally don't think that that's true. I think that books and materials, facilities and buildings are all about tools that we go to fulfill this process of knowledge creation. Schools, by the way, are also in the knowledge creation business. They come at it with different approaches, different pedagogy, different values. But they, you know, you don't look at a school and say, boy, they're all about the chalkboards.
Yeah.
You know, and yet, you know, we become, romance is a good word. We've become in love over centuries with the book and the materials and reading as one of the primary processes. And so it takes a lot to sort of wiggle that mm-hmm. from, wait, we've fallen in love with the tools, let's get back to what we're talking about. And with the advent of the internet and e-books and digital delivery, we've had to be shaken to say, now, wait a minute, what do you really like? So my wife and I, when we went to go buy our second house, actually, we had this great realtor, mm-hmm. and she sat down and said, all right, what do you need? And I said, well, we need a two-car garage. She goes, all right, if I found you the perfect house in the perfect location with everything, but it had a one-car garage, would you still do it? Yeah. And, you know, and just, you know, well, we need a kitchen, and we need a pool, and we need, you know. Yeah. And so at every point, she sort of forced you to say, if I had everything else but this, you know, to really challenge what is essential. Mm-hmm. And now what's happening with e-books and digital books is we're being shaken away from that that comfort of a tool,
yeah.
books and materials, and said, well, you know, are you still librarians if you don't have that, right? So part of the Atlas, part of my reason I wrote that book and started down this process was because I was asked by the dean of Drexel's information school. He said, can you define a librarianship without a library?
Yeah.
And it took me a couple years to come out to it because I had, every time I came up with a definition, I had to smack myself and say, all right, but does it really need this?
Yeah, that's what's so extremely interesting about what you have to say here, to me anyway, from a philosophical point of view, in that you've got a real normative definition, which is something like, you know, an alchemical elixir for healing, you know, wrongheadedness and doubts. It's not just a positive description, you know, of what goes on, but it's something you can see you've thought about a long time and brought a lot of experience to, and then really come to something that you can take it with you and apply to various situations and come out with an understanding you didn't have before.
Well, and that was the attempt, but someone really came at me and asked a really good question. They said, you know, aren't you really describing sort of a post-library librarian? In other words, the idea that by your definition, you sort of made the collection and such irrelevant. Doesn't that really dissolve one of the fundamental parts of our profession? And so it made me do a lot of thinking. And what I came back to was, I think what I'm describing is a post-document view of librarianship. And if you think about it for a moment, let's just say that a collection is an essential part of a library and it's an essential part of what a librarian does. The question is why? I come back to why. You know, are you building the collection for the collection's sake, the librarian's sake, or the people who are going to get benefit out of it? Mm-hmm. Sort of collection focus versus community focus. That's why I say things like the community is ultimately your collection, not the materials and tools you bring to bear on them. But the other thing is, let's just say you love books. Let's say you think we are in the document business. We're in a point now where we've entered into a metaphor of the document, right? So e-books are not books that are electronic. They're not. We want them to be. We want to price them that way. We want to buy them that way. We want to read them that way. We want them to be books, but on screen.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is they're not. They're bits. And the bits can be interactive. The bits can change on a regular basis. The format and the way you display it can change. If you're reading on a Kindle versus reading on a computer screen versus reading on your phone, that's not a book in the way that we've come to understand, catalog, organize, and shelve them. You can't do that anymore. You can do all this other stuff you couldn't do before. You can add video to it, interactivity to it, multiple voices to it, multiple annotations. All this stuff you can do is no longer a book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no longer a static information object or knowledge container, as it's been called, which we can get into later,
mm-hmm.
because it's this dynamic network of ideas that we've combined and give it a name. Oh, hell, call it an e-book. But is it? I'm not sure. It's a document, but it's living and breathing. And so if you pin your definition of what a librarian is to the document,
mm-hmm.
and the document is in the middle of changing, what does that do with your definition of the librarian?
It is all tied to your understanding of what knowledge is here, isn't
yeah.
it? Which is something, the way you define it, isn't something that exists in artifacts, you know, whether we're talking print or digital artifacts, but it exists in human minds and between these minds in the acts of communication. And
mm-hmm.
I should say that really rang a bell with me as a medievalist, you know, because I've had it drilled into me that when you look at a medieval book, you're not looking at something that was regarded as a container of any kind,
right,
the way we do. You know, instead, it's basically a tool to help you remember what was already known. Mm-hmm. It's storing to meet, is the way the cyberneticists describe that. Or else sometimes, you know, books are considered to be something like living beings themselves who speak to their readers, but that's just a sort of projection of the same idea that knowledge is in language and in communication. So I wonder then about your understanding of the term information.
The classic definition of information is built on something called the, let's see, DIKW hierarchy, data, information, knowledge, wisdom hierarchy. Yeah. And the idea is that, you know, when you get a measurement, ones and zeros and twos and metrics, that's data. When you add context to that data, so, you know, 1 degree outside as opposed to one, some way of understanding the context or contextualizing it, then it becomes information. Mm-hmm. When you can then sort of apply it and relate it to other information, it becomes knowledge. And finally, when you can act upon it appropriately, it becomes wisdom. Now, that sounds terribly rational, and we present it in information schools and such as if it were terribly rational. The problem is it is anthropomorphic. It is anthrocentric. Mm-hmm. It is human-centric. In other words, what is context to me is not necessarily context to you. The way in which that data was gathered matters, for example. The way in which we understand it. When I hand someone the book I wrote, one could believe that they're going to get more information out of it than I am, because if I look at a book I've written, it's sort of refreshing. There's maybe new ideas. If you hand it to a 2-year-old, how much knowledge or information are they going to glean from it? So the problem is that even if you define it, quote-unquote, objectively according to this hierarchy, you're still back to defining it as what's going on in someone's head. Mm-hmm. And that's back to the other definition of, you know, information is a difference that makes a difference. Well, what makes a difference to me and what makes a difference to you, two different things. We're back to the idea of defining knowledge or information as sort of a human, individually assigned thing, which is where I sit. You know, if you look at other classic definitions like Shannon's definition of information and the information theory with channels and noise and all that, he's really talking about data. Mm-hmm. When you hear all these reports about how much information there is in the world and how many exabytes, they're talking about data. So I have a real problem with defining information outside of the context of knowledge, meaning what we know and how it affects our behavior. Mm-hmm. So when I question, is there such a thing as information, what I'm really questioning is the information as this unbiased thing, to me, I have a hard time ever getting back to what it is. Even some people say, well, it's semantic information, which is a cop-out because semantic just means meaning. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, what semantic data to me and semantic data to you is different. I cleaned out my office the other day because it's the start of the school year, and I found zip disks. Mm-hmm. Remember zip disks?
I remember zip disks. Not too long ago, it seems.
No, right. Yeah, there's little cartridges, and they can store like megabytes of information. Yeah, right now they're useless because I have no zip reader. So is that an information container, a knowledge container, or is that simply a thing? Yeah. Meanwhile, I look at an apple, and I can tell you what kind of apple it is, how ripe it is, and yet it wasn't created as some information container, and yet I can extract information from it.
Interesting.
So this is back to another debate I often get into, which is people sort of want to quickly label me as this postmodernist and everything's relative and such. And I actually don't go there because I just think that life is too complex for us to figure out. You know, someone said, aren't libraries in the fact business? And I said, libraries can be in the fact business all they want, but it's frankly irrelevant because it's really what we do with the facts. It's how we behave. It's the impact that these things have. And that's the business that libraries are in, not the accumulation of facts, but the impact that they have within communities.
So I thought it might be useful to have you talk about the new librarianship and how it might play out with various kinds of libraries. And I thought we might start with public libraries. So you have a great reference to Melville Dewey where he refers to public libraries as being co-equal partners with public schools in the education of the American public. And I wonder if public libraries still have this role in society and how you see public libraries in the future.
I think they do, and I think they're realizing it again. I think Carnegie really shaped public libraries when he went out and gave money to build buildings. Mm-hmm. And he looked at it as, you know, he didn't look at it as a fiction and entertainment function. He looked at it as an educating the masses function. You know,
yeah,
he wanted
democratizing. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. If people are going to vote, they should damn well know what they're voting for, as opposed to good luck. And, you know, not that he was a saint by any means.
No, he was probably hoping they would vote Republican, I'm thinking.
Yeah, that's right, you know, against the workers' cause. But but this idea really sort of, so democracy became this part of the mythos of public libraries. And the reason I say it's mythos is because a lot of people, Bushman, for example, pointed out the fact that we say it all the time, but we've never measured it. Right? Has anyone measured, for example, participation in elections by proximity to libraries? Has anyone ever gone in and polled regular library users for their knowledge of policy and current trends? You know, we say it, but we don't actually go and find out if we have that effect. We just sort of assume if we provide stuff and people access the stuff, good things will happen. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work that way. Yeah. So on one hand, I think libraries have always had the mythos that they're in the learning business and the democracy business and such. It's just now what's happening is we're realizing that the tools that we use can change for that. We can do it with built maker spaces and 3D printers. We can do it with story times. We can do it with blending out fishing poles and these kinds of things.
Yeah, there are libraries that rent out people who have memory and knowledge, certain kinds of experience that...
Absolutely. I mean, there's the human library. I've seen entrepreneurship where public libraries seek to help people create their own businesses, and you can rent out an accountant and a lawyer and these kinds of things to help you with that. But the other thing that public libraries, and I would say progressive public libraries, are realizing is that, once again, how active the librarians are in that process. In other words, it's not enough to say we create, it's like Piaget's old learning environment of kindergarten, where we create a vital, interesting learning environment and then we set people free. We realize that sometimes people need some guidance through that, and that librarians can be providing that guidance. It's still, unlike, say, public education, where there's a curriculum and you're delivering instructions, it's still what we call inquiry-based, meaning it's the individual who's driving what they're learning about in the pace, but librarians need to be active in the process as well. So we can't simply say, good news, we've built this beautiful collection of materials and tools for you, go at it. We'll be dealing with the materials and tools. We have to actually be individually dealing with the folks in their learning process. So we're seeing that. We see that in big libraries. We see it in Chattanooga and Tennessee where they're building this. We see this in San Francisco. We see this in small libraries. We see this in Fayetteville Free Library, which is about 20 minutes from where I am, and they're building maker spaces, and they're building, they have, you know, dev days and teaching people how to code and all these kinds of things, and they're a really small library. So it's not a size thing. It really is a looking at these issues. And then when you go to voters and once again you say you need support for the library or don't close the library, it's very different than don't close the building. It's don't close the services and functions.
Yeah, yeah. You can't talk about dusty shelves anymore.
Well, right, and you know, even see things like patron-driven acquisition. I had one library director, she started up a new library, she looked at the collection, saw the circulation was zero, saw the collection was from 1972, and she instantly said, okay, any book that anyone requests, we buy, period. They come in and they say, do you have this book? And we say, no. The answer is not no. The answer is, we will in 3 days and go order it. And we see that in Canada, for example, many public libraries in Canada have what are called floating collections. And that means that you have a consortium or a system of five libraries. And as people request materials from other libraries, they sort of float to that person's library and they stay there. And over time, what happens is the collections begin to, instead of being generic among the five, each one of those becomes sort of a very specialized, very community-looking library. So, you know, there's all different ways of implementing this idea of learner-centric, member-centric ways of handling public education that go far beyond, we have this stuff just in case you need it. You know, and it's from everywhere but us. That's the other thing that libraries used to be great about. If you're going to go visit New Orleans, and you go into the public library and you say, tell me about New Orleans. Right now, they would say, well, this is everything about everywhere else because we're educating the people of New Orleans. Well, where's the New Orleans feel? Where's the vibe? Where's the materials they're producing?
Yeah, and it seems that's certainly an area that libraries should be looking to for the future, is developing collections and making collections of local materials and local history. I mean, it's something you can only do on the local level, really. So
exactly. And someone once said, well, the fear we have is that if we give up the books and collections, it'll be too confusing. We'll just be community centers. And my answer back to them is, what's wrong with being the center of a community? I know what they mean, but, you know, we're allowed to twist our words when we need to. Community centers are such a well-defined and universal concept. Yeah. But
well, in your definition, you could regard a librarian as a community organizer, I mean, apart from a teacher of kind. So.
Absolutely. I mean, they're a hub in which part of what their job should be doing is not only connecting you to resources, but connecting you to other people within and outside of your community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, hey, you asked that question. Did you know that Bob just asked that question as well? Yeah. Maybe there's something interesting to go on here.
Yeah. So school libraries are really suffering in the current economic climate, which seems completely, to me anyway, counterintuitive, given how important information skills of all kinds have become in every area of study. And studies show that even with schools focused now on testing, which I don't think is a good idea, but even given that, having a good school librarian has a noticeable effect on the quality of work that students are able to do. So I wonder why school libraries are getting hit so hard and what teachers, parents, and librarians can do to change this situation and make their libraries more integral to how students in the schools learn.
It's a very interesting question, and school libraries are an area in which the library profession specifically, but communities in general, need to do a lot of work to shore up. I once talked to a teacher, and she'd moved from one school to another school, and she came to me about 2 weeks after working in a new school, and she goes, "Now I get what you're saying about school librarians." And I said, "Well, what's the difference?" And she goes, "Because I had a school librarian that actually does that." Uh-huh. You know, the idea that, unfortunately, many administrators, many teachers, many folks have encountered school librarians before they really went through a transformation from clerks to teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that, you know, there was really a ramp up in the skills of profession, and unfortunately it's not as widespread as it should be. But this idea that a good school librarian becomes an essential player to behavior. The other thing that goes on, and you brought up politics earlier, how much easier is it to say that we're getting rid of non-teaching staff, even though librarians are certified teachers?
Yeah.
The idea that when we're presented with a question of, well, do you want 25 students in the classroom or 30, a parent is going to do anything to get the 25 number, regardless of the other things you put up against it, right? Whether it's the new music program, the new turf field, the new whatever it is, we want teachers in classrooms because, frankly, we need them. What we need to begin to understanding is that those librarians are the teachers as well. Mm-hmm. And they're not teaching a special subject. They're teaching essential skills for all subjects. One of the things that's happening is I think all but about three states have adopted something called the Common Core. And the Common Core is a way of saying, you know, if you're a second grader, you should know this in reading. If you're a third grader, you should know this in reading, et cetera. And eventually they're reading and mathematics and other subjects. And if you're a librarian of the old school, you'll say, great, what I'll do is I will go identify resources that meet those criteria. The good school librarians, the brilliant school librarians, which I love having met and been part of and consider good friends, are the ones who look at it and say, oh, so they have to locate information resources. I better teach how to locate information resources, not provide this pre-organized list of things that might match that criteria.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of looking at engaging the people in the process and not the things and the materials. And so we have a situation where every study that has looked at school libraries and school librarians have found that it's the school librarians that make the difference. In other words, having a library in the building doesn't affect outcomes. Having a school librarian in that building does. And so I would say we need to be better at making that message. We need to be more, frankly, political in how we make that message and understand and define librarians, school librarians.
Yeah. So finally, let's look at academic libraries. I've worked in institutions that certainly valued their libraries. At Yale, we used to call the library system a university within a university. And even though this was true, there always seemed to me to be a sort of moat separating one institution from the other, a moat with a very narrow drawbridge. According to recent studies about student attitudes toward research, most undergraduates are at a complete loss when it comes to doing research in the library for writing assignments, especially starting out. Although they understand about lectures and textbooks and classroom assignments, They tend to look upon academic libraries as mysterious islands on their campuses, shrouded in mists, and when they need help, they tend to turn to either their peers, which is a bad idea sometimes, or fall back on resources that they learned about actually in high school in their high school libraries. They'll rely on one or two tools like Project Muse or JSTOR for information. There's a movement underway in academic circles to better integrate libraries and librarians into course planning processes, but these are still pretty much fledgling programs when they exist, and we all know from experience that we can do a lot of strategic planning and not have it go anywhere, especially in the academy. We tend to be very slow-moving institutions when it comes to change, and especially curricular change. So I don't know if this has to do with a basic historical rift between two cultures in academia, one based on teaching and the other on research, but I wonder how the new librarianship can help.
It's an interesting question. One person once referred to this metaphor that the library was the heart of the campus, and he goes, you know, these days I think it's much more the spleen. And I said, you know, ideally it's the circulatory system. It's the one that sort of links people up with working in interesting ideas in disparate fields, because if academia is one problem, it's definitely that we stovepipe everything, that the philosophers hang with the philosophers, the physicists hang with the physicists, etc. And there's lots of initiatives to try and break down those walls, interdisciplinary such. And it's one of those that sounds better, and then it's actually been implemented. So one thing that we're dealing with is we're dealing with a library that spans all of these stovepipes. And that puts us in an awkward position because we don't look like a stovepipe. The other thing is you have to break out that academic type. For example, I talk to academic librarians at community colleges. The community colleges, one of the things that they deal with the most is they're bringing in a whole new culture to higher education. You know, they're dealing with culture that people maybe got through primary and secondary education, which is highly formalized. It is well structured. It is, you know, as I tell freshmen coming in, I said, you know, I hope you really enjoyed your senior year in high school. It was the last professional teacher you'll ever talk to, you know, because I'm an information scientist and I teach. That's different than being a teacher that teaches information science. But what's happening to the community culture is not only are they dealing with that, but they're dealing with the fact that, and public libraries as well, that people are coming from different cultures. For example, a lot of underserved cultures in the United States have an almost oral tradition to how they learn. Deb Turner at Drexel has done some great work on this. But, you know, you come from an African-American community or a Latino community where their access to the Internet is the phone, which is very different than having access on a laptop. And, you know, when they need to know what's going on, they ask someone. This was put to me very eloquently when I was in Italy, and they said, when someone wants to know the recipe for sauce, they ask their mother. They don't go to a library. And, you know, the idea that libraries are foreign in the sense that come in, and yes, you can be inquiry-driven, but if you're in an oral culture, we have nothing to offer you.
And of course, teaching is based on talking. It is an oral culture, so.
Yeah, and so what I'm seeing in academic libraries is besides the fact that they realize that the space that they provide has value above and beyond the shelving. I know that's a little step, but when you see things like commons, and you see the coffee areas, and you see meeting rooms, and you see the idea of allowing freshmen and undergraduates and graduate students to come in and work together, that's the beginning of understanding that they have more to offer than just the stacks of materials and licensing. And now what we're seeing is, once again, how we can integrate ourselves into the actual teaching process. And that's tough because, you know, I have to teach my first class of the semester tonight. Guess when I put the syllabus together? Well, the answer is, how much longer do we have on this phone call?
Exactly. So, and the classroom, from a faculty perspective, is sort of sacrosanct. You don't want to give up authority in the classroom if you can avoid it, because that relationship between you and your student, at least in your mind, is something sacred. So,
well, that's an idealistic way of looking at that.
It is.
You can throw it the other way, which is that the classroom is the burden which we place upon researchers, right? So in which case, I don't want you in there because I don't want you showing me how bad I am. But unfortunately, the net result of both of those is not inviting in these other support systems.
Right, it makes both sides dysfunctional in a way.
Right. So we see this in online education and the integration of technology. You know, now the idea that integrating technology in my teaching was horrible and terrible until I realized that I could just take my overhead slides and turn them into PowerPoint and do the exact same thing. You know, we still haven't quite fixed the problem here, And so we have the situation where librarians in academia have to fight a lot of battles above and beyond just do they have status. And I look at, you know, MOOCs and the idea of online education as a real opportunity for librarians to show that they've been inquiry-driven, that they're about helping people learn not in a structured curricular way, but in an ad hoc, on-demand way.
Technology seems to be one way we can help shake the old system loose a little bit, and communication of any kind. I mean, because librarians are essentially generalists, we're disciplinary generalists, we're in a privileged position to do that in the academy, you know, if we were willing to step in and actually regard ourselves as peers.
So yeah, I agree.
You mentioned MOOCs, and of course you have experience teaching on a MOOC, and a MOOC is a course that one could take. It stands for Massively Open Online Course. Generally, they're open to anyone who wants to take them, as was yours. I wondered if you see it as a game changer at all, not just for libraries, but in higher education.
I don't think it's a game changer per se. In other words, there's a lot of people loading a lot of stuff onto MOOCs, right?
Yeah.
You've got one that want to load the whole disruption of higher education onto MOOC, where we're going to democratize the access to information, make it cheap and easy and universal, and therefore we won't need these big, monolithic, expensive institutions. I don't think that's going to show up because people are underestimating what a university does. It's not just about teaching. It's also about discovering the information that is being taught. One of my favorite lines actually came out of a comment after a speaker in an Oxford lecture, and he said, one of the great utilities of a university is they can sustain arguments over long periods of time. And he didn't mean arguments as in, I'm mad at so-and-so,
yes.
But we've been debating what is the meaning of life for centuries, and a university is a place in which we give the liberty to do that when we don't have a bottom line, and where we don't have deadlines within 10 seconds. And so I worry that if the MOOCs simply become a new way of doing lecture-based teaching, we lose a lot in research and such. The other thing I've realized is that if we look at the MOOC as new business models, what have you, if we don't change our pedagogy, we're in trouble anyway. And that really, for me, the change, whether it's a MOOC or not a MOOC, or I don't care, but the problem that higher education is facing is that we used to prepare people for a much more static environment that they would go into, primarily a jobs environment,
yeah.
But not exclusively. So that it used to be that when you got your bachelor's in engineering, you could be an engineer for the rest of your life. Then it turned into, well, your bachelor's will get you through the first 5 years. Then you got to get a master's, and then you go into administration, and then you're not an engineer anymore. And now we're to the point where, you know, you're a librarian for a year, and then you better start retraining into what's coming next. And so the shift that in higher education isn't around, we can now teach 2,000 students at a time, because the truth is you can only teach 2,000 people at the same time if you use a really traditional lecture-based model.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not going to be the revolution. The revolution will be when higher education realizes that they need to not certify someone at the beginning of their career and then call them alumni and ask for money, but they really need to be almost a subscription-based model where someone enters into that learning environment and gets to access it whenever they have it along the way. And not only that, but if they gather information or knowledge from another institution's source material, they can come back to their home institution and say, would you please certify that I know this? And so the dream is that we can create a medical record where, you know, you won't have to constantly fill out forms with every new doctor you see, where your information will follow you throughout your life. Well, imagine an education record that does the classic, this is going on your permanent record, where you can literally say, you know, I just took this MOOC over at Syracuse, and I did this class over at Cortland, and I did another class at Berkeley, and Syracuse is going to hold my record to certify that I know it, I did it. And so if you want to know, do I know how to be a good librarian, philosopher, engineer, et cetera, Syracuse knows the latest that I've done and can provide you that information.
Yeah.
That's a much more fundamental shift than the idea that we're letting 2,000 people hear my lecture instead of 30 bored people hearing my lecture.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of possibility. I have to say, I like the option, though, of you know, when someone says something interesting in a lecture, you tend to contemplate what they've said, and then you don't hear for 5 minutes everything that they say that follows. So, you know, one can go back and rewind and play. But then it occurred to me, from your point of view, the person doing the lecturing, I know you engaged your students an awful lot in online discourses about what you were talking about. You must change your mind about what you have to say about any given topic over the course of the class, and just to rerun the same video, you know, the next semester probably isn't going to make you happy, although it might save you a little work. And you would want to go back and make changes. So I don't know if it saves the instructor a lot of time just lecturing that way. But
I'm trying an experiment this semester. So I was in the hospital at the beginning of this year for like 25 days. It was horrible. Anyway, and I'd just been diagnosed with lymphoma. And so, good news, all gone. I'm 21 days cancer-free. But my brother-in-law teaches freshman biology at a pharmacy college. Mm-hmm. And he had just what he called flipped the classroom. In other words, his lectures, you watch them online at your own discretion. When you come into class, that's for discussion and activities and sort of hands-on stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I can lecture to you. There's no reason you have to sit together for that time. You can do it whenever you want. And what was interesting is as I was going through this diagnosis, he started sending me his lectures going, oh, they just said that you had a compromised T-cell. This is what a T-cell is. And then I could actually take his class and figure out what was going on with me at a distance. Now, that's technology enabling you to do really cool stuff. And so I'm taking the MOOC that I taught for 2000, and actually I'm saying, you know what? My class tonight is Introduction to Librarianship. Go watch the lectures there, and when you come into class once a week for 3 hours, we're going to spend the time talking about the ideas that were confused you or not. We're going to spend the time on activities, building, talking to librarians on field trips. That's where technology is enabling me to change how I teach and enrich how I teach. But you're absolutely right. I'm looking at those videos going, you're right, I would like to change them here and there and such.
Yeah, it's a sort of living performance, and none of us are static. So a couple of final questions about the new librarianship. What's the difference between a good library and a great library? This question you ask in Expect More.
Yeah. It's interesting because in the introduction to the Atlas of New Librarianship, I said, this used to be called participatory librarianship, but when something just becomes universal, you drop the modifier, so it just is librarianship. And unfortunately, everyone's now felt they need to add the modifier new back to it. To me, it's just good librarianship. Yeah. Yeah. But I understand that that gets to be my point of view, not everyone's.
Want to buy it, so...
The power of labels. You know, for me, a bad library pays attention to its collection. A good library pays attention to services, and a great library pays attention to its community. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all about engagement. It's all about focus. You know, the idea of a good library is they have a good collection. I can ask them questions, sort of. I can go to them to get what they offer me as a community member. But the focus there means the library is defining where it's going to happen, what's available to it. A great library goes to the community and says, what do you need? An advisor once called it the anti-field of dreams model, right? Mm-hmm. The field of dreams from the movie is build it and they will come. Mm-hmm. And a good library can build a good field, right? Mm-hmm. They can build a good collection. They can build good story hours. They can build maker spaces. They can build lots of stuff in a library and wait for the community to come. But a great library waits to find out what the community needs and then runs around as fast as they can to build it. So you get libraries that are debating, should we have makerspaces? Should we put in 3D printers and computing manufacturing and all that? And
that's the way it usually works. And you're thinking about the Joneses next door, too, you know, the next community.
Yeah.
They've got this. Why shouldn't we have this also?
Right,
that's
exactly.
That's the way academic libraries are.
And public libraries and libraries in general have been, you know, Melville Dewey's great legacy, which we're trying to break right now, was efficiency over everything else, right? He was the decimal system was based on the metric system, and he was a constant reformer for efficiency. So the idea is if it works in one library, it should work in all of them, because that saves us all time from having to figure it out. We need to break that and say, no, effectiveness is more important than efficiency. We don't all have to have a makerspace. And it's not because we can afford it or we don't agree with it, it's because whether our communities need it or not.
Yes.
And so a great library is one that spends time within their community seeking out what they're trying to accomplish and then aligns their services to match it, as opposed to having great services in case.
So what are the grand challenges that you talk about that librarians should be thinking about?
So this is where the difference between libraries and librarians to me shows up. Libraries are local institutions serving with a mission and resources and a charter and such to serve a local community. As a profession, librarians are dedicated to serving that need, but they also, as a profession, need to think in the larger context. And the larger context for me is that we've talked about living in the information age, and we talk about the idea of technology changing and all these other things. And what we really do is we live in this knowledge economy. We've shifted from a primary agrarian to a primary industrial, and increasingly are transforming into a primary service and knowledge or information economy. That economy, which is how we allocate resources to education, how we allocate it to governance, how we allocate it to all these other things, has an infrastructure, an economy to it, an infrastructure that says we have people, technology, permissions, and services to make available. Right now, that infrastructure is ad hoc. It's often conflicting. It's increasingly about consumerism, meaning we have a telecommunications infrastructure where we want telecommunications people to compete, and yet we still make them so that if I call you and you're on AT&T and I'm on Verizon, we can still talk to each other. Mm-hmm. But increasingly now, with a device like I have an iPhone and you have an Android phone, and the problem is that my iPhone, I can't create an app. I can buy them, I can download them, but I can't create on it. So it's consumer-driven. Mm-hmm. And I can only download an app from Apple's walled garden. In other words, I can't go and say, oh, you've got a good one on Android, I want it. And So we have a knowledge economy and infrastructure that is in competition. In some places, that's good. It drives down prices, creates mm-hmm. efficiencies. But in many cases, no one's thought about the greater need for knowing these things over time, the idea of preventing loss of information, the idea of what is a public good and what is a private good. And so for me, the grand challenges among librarianships is how do we coordinate that knowledge infrastructure to come up with the right balance of public, private, consumer, mm-hmm. producer? How do we really create a knowledge infrastructure that allows everyone to participate if they choose? How do we not create the cell phone slum? The cell phone slum is you have access to the internet, but only through the cell phone. That's a slum because you can't do everything that someone who can spend $3,000 on a really good machine can do.
So will this all come about, do you think, by popular demand or other pressures from outside, this new way of looking at libraries and librarianship, or is it something that librarians really need to come to understand and promote themselves if it's ever come to pass?
I think it's, as all things are, a combination of both of those things. Mm-hmm. I think that we know from years and years and years of information system research, right? So we're going to develop a new word processor. We're going to develop a new web browser. We're going to develop a new whatever. Let's go out and ask people what they want. We want to be user-based. We know from study after study that what people say they want is exactly what they have, but a little bit better. and they can't define what a little bit better is, but they want it to be a little bit better. Right? So if you hand someone an iPhone and say, how would you do this differently? They would look at you and they'd say, oh, it'd be more iPhone-y. Right? So if you remember what smartphones looked like before the introduction of the iPhone, they all had a keypad on them. They all had a place to type. And afterwards, they were all touchscreens. Mm-hmm. It took someone, in this case Apple, to sort of reconceptualize and show people a new opportunity. And then that led to wide-scale adoption. So what we need to do is we need to, first of all, find people within the profession who are doing really cool things, showcase them widely, and that will create public demand for those kinds of services. So it's a cycle of showing and demonstrating, which leads to demand, which leads to adoption. And so it's a combination of libraries pushing and then communities pushing back or pulling you further. So, because, you know, I don't blame people who look at their library and say, I love my library. And when's the last time you were in it? Never. So why do you love it? Because you're supposed to love a library. I was raised to love a library. Yeah. And to say, well, what happens if your library has no books? Well, then it wouldn't be a library. And what they're really saying is, I don't know what that would be, mm-hmm. as opposed to saying, but what if it did this and this and this and this and this, and it's like, oh yeah, that would be great. So we need to showcase and demonstrate, and that's our job, not the community's job. The community's job is to need things. It's our job to figure out the appropriate solutions.
Yeah. So I'd like to thank you, David, for joining us on the Library Cafe today to talk about the new librarianship and your book, The Atlas of New Librarianship, and also Expect More, Demanding Better Libraries for Today's Complex World, both of which can be obtained on Amazon.
And thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.